animated for a while. Then he rests. It's very regular and very calming, to tell you the truth." They paid the bill and walked out to the parking lot. May saw the white wisps of her father's hair through the car window. Most of his head was below the window frame, reclined so far he was in the back seat. When they arrived at the car, they saw that he was awake, looking up into the interlocking boughs of an unremarkable tree. He rolled down the window.
"Well, this has been wonderful," he said.
May made her goodbyes and left, happy to have the afternoon free. She drove west, the day sunny and calm, the colors of the passing landscape simple and clear, blues and yellows and greens. As she approached the coast, she turned toward the bay. She could get a few hours of kayaking in if she hurried. Mercer had introduced her to kayaking, an activity that until then she'd considered awkward and dull. Sitting at the waterline, struggling to move that strange ice cream spoon paddle, the constant twisting looked painful, and the pace seemed far too slow. But then she'd tried it, with Mercer, using not professional-grade models, but something more basic, the kind the rider sits on top of, legs and feet exposed. They'd paddled around the bay, moving far quicker than she'd expected, and they'd seen harbor seals and pelicans. And May was convinced this was a criminally underappreciated sport, and the bay a body of water woefully underused. They launched from a tiny beach, the outfitter requiring no training or equipment or fuss. You just paid your $15 an hour and in minutes were on the bay, cold and clear. Today, she pulled off the highway and made her way to the beach, and there she found the water placid, glassine.
"Hey, you," said a voice.
May turned to find an older woman, bow-legged and frizzy-haired. This was Marion, owner of Maiden's Voyages. She was the maiden and had been for 15 years, since she'd opened the business after striking it rich in stationery. She told May this during her first rental, and told everyone this story, which Marion assumed was amusing, that she'd made money selling stationery and opened a kayak and paddleboard rental operation. Why Marion thought this was funny, May never knew. But Marion was warm and accommodating, even when May was asking to take out a kayak a few hours before closing, as she was this day.
"Gorgeous out there," Marion said. "Just don't go far."
Marion helped her pull the kayak across the sand and rocks and into the tiny waves. She clicked on May's life preserver.
"And remember, don't bother any of the houseboat people. Their living rooms are at your eye level, so no snooping. You want footies or a windbreaker today?" she asked. "Might get choppy."
May declined and got into the kayak, barefoot and wearing the cardigan and jeans she wore to brunch. In seconds, she had paddled beyond the fishing boats, past the breakers and paddleboarders, and was in the open water of the bay. She saw no one. That this body of water was so seldom used had confounded her for months. There were no jet skis here, few casual fishermen, no water skiers, the occasional motorboat. There were sailboats, but not nearly as many as one would expect. The frigid water was only part of it. Maybe there were simply too many other things to do outdoors in Northern California. It was mysterious, but May had no complaint. It left more water to her. She paddled into the belly of the bay. The water did indeed get choppier, and cold water washed over her feet. It felt good, so good she reached her hand down and scooped a handful and drenched her face and the back of her neck. When she opened her eyes, she saw a harbor seal, 20 feet in front of her, staring at her as would a calm dog whose yard she'd walked into. His head was rounded, gray, with the glossy sheen of polished marble. She kept her paddle on her lap, watching the seal as it watched her. Its eyes were black buttons, unreflective. She didn't move, and the seal didn't move. They were locked in mutual regard, and the moment, the way it stretched and luxuriated in itself, asked for continuation. Why move? A gust of wind came her way, and with it the pungent smell of the seal. She had noticed this the last time she had kayaked, the strong smell of these animals, a cross between tuna and unwashed dog. It was better to be upwind. As if suddenly embarrassed, the seal ducked underwater. May continued on, away from shore. She set a goal to make it to a red buoy she spotted, near the bend of a peninsula, deep in the bay. Getting to it would take 30 minutes or so, and en route she would pass a few dozen anchored barges and sailboats. Many had been made into homes of one kind or another, and she knew not to look into the windows, but she couldn't help it. There were mysteries aboard. Why was there a motorcycle on this barge? Why a Confederate flag on that yacht? Far off, she saw a seaplane circling. The wind picked up behind her, sending her quickly past the red buoy and closer to the farther shore. She hadn't planned to land there, and had never made it across the bay, but soon it was in sight, and coming quickly upon her, eelgrass visible beneath her as the water went shallow. She jumped out of the kayak, her feet landing on the stones, all rounded and smooth. As she was pulling the kayak up, the bay rose up and engulfed her legs. It wasn't a wave, it was more of a sudden uniform rising of the water level. One second she was standing on a dry shore, and the next the water was at her shins and she was soaked. When the water fell again, it left a wide swath of bizarre, bejeweled seaweed, blue and green and, in a certain light, iridescent. She held it in her hands, and it was smooth, rubbery, its edges ruffled extravagantly. May's feet were wet, and the water was snow-cold, but she didn't mind. She sat on the rocky beach, picked up a stick, and drew with it, clicking through the smooth stones. Tiny crabs, unearthed and annoyed, scurried to find new shelters. A pelican landed downshore on the trunk of a dead tree, which had been bleached white and leaned diagonally, rising from the steel-gray water, pointing lazily to the sky. And then May found herself sobbing. Her father was a mess. No, he wasn't a mess. He was managing it all with great dignity. But there had been something very tired about him that morning, something defeated, accepting, as if he knew that he couldn't fight both what was happening in his body and the companies managing his care. And there was nothing she could do for him. No, there was too much to do for him. She could quit her job, she could quit and help make the phone calls, fight the many fights to keep him well. This is what a good daughter would do, what a good child and only child would do. A good only child would spend the next 3 to 5 years, which might be his last years of mobility, a full capability, with him, helping her mother, being part of the family machinery. But she knew her parents wouldn't let her do all that. They wouldn't allow it. And so she would be caught between the job she needed and loved and her parents, whom she couldn't help. But it felt good to cry, to let her shoulders shake, to feel the hot tears on her face, to taste their baby salt, to wipe snot all over the underside of her shirt. And when she was done, she pushed the kayak out again, and she found herself paddling at a brisk pace. Once in the middle of the bay, she stopped. Her tears were dry now, her breathing steady. She was calm and felt strong, but instead of reaching the red buoy, which she no longer had any interest in, she sat, her paddle on her lap, letting the waves tilt her gently, feeling the warm sun dry her hands and feet. She often did this when she was far from any shore. She just sat still, feeling the vast volume of the ocean beneath her. There were leopard sharks in this part of the bay, and bat rays, and jellyfish, and the occasional harbor porpoise, but she could see none of them. They were hidden in the dark water, in their black parallel world, and knowing they were there, but not knowing where or really anything else, felt, at that moment, strangely right. Far beyond, she could see where the mouth of the bay led to the ocean, and there, making its way through a band of light fog, she saw an enormous container ship heading out into open water. She thought about moving, but saw no point. There seemed no reason to go anywhere. Being here, in the middle of the bay, nothing to do or see, was plenty. She stayed there, drifting slowly, for the better part of an hour. Occasionally she would smell that dog and tuna smell again and turn to find another curious seal, and they would watch each other, and she would wonder if the seal knew, as she did, how good this was, how lucky they were to have all this to themselves. By the late afternoon, the winds coming from the Pacific picked up, and getting back to shore was trying. When she got home, her limbs were leaden, and her head was slow. She made herself a salad and ate half a bag of chips, staring out the window. She fell asleep at 8, and slept for 11 hours. The morning was busy, as Dan had warned her it would be. He'd gathered her and the 100-odd other CE reps at 8 a.m., reminding them all that opening the chute on Monday morning was always a hazardous thing. All the customers who wanted answers over the weekend certainly expected them on Monday morning. He was right. The chute opened, the deluge arrived, and May worked against the flood until 11 or so, when there was something like respite. She'd handled 49 queries, and her score was at 91, her lowest aggregate yet.
"Don't worry," Jared messaged. "Par for the course on Monday. Just go after as many follow-ups as you can."
May had been following up all morning, with limited results. The clients were grumpy. The only good news that morning came from the intra-company feed, when a message from Francis appeared, asking her to lunch. Officially, she and the other CE staff were given an hour for the meal, but she hadn't seen anyone else leave their desk for more than 20 minutes. She gave herself that much time, though her mother's words, equating lunch with a monumental breach of duty, rattled in her mind. She was late getting to the glass eatery. She looked around and up, and finally saw him sitting a few levels above, his feet dangling from a high lucite stool. She waved, but couldn't get his attention. She yelled up to him, as discreetly as she could, to no avail. Then, feeling foolish, she texted him, and watched as he received the text, looked around the cafeteria, found her, and waved. She made her way through the line, got a veggie burrito and some kind of new organic soda, and sat down next to him. He was wearing a wrinkled, clean button-down shirt and carpenter's pants. His perch overlooked the outdoor pool, where a group of staffers were approximating a game of volleyball.
"Not such an athletic group," he noted.
"No," May agreed. As he watched the chaotic splashing below, she tried to overlay this face in front of her with the one she remembered from her first night. There were the same heavy brows, the same prominent nose, but now Francis seemed to have shrunk. His hands, using a knife and fork to cut his burrito in two, seemed unusually delicate.
"It's almost perverse," he said. "Having so much athletic equipment here when there's no athletic aptitude at all, it's like a family of Christian Scientists living next to a pharmacy."
Now he turned to her.
"Thanks for coming. I wondered if I'd see you again."
"Yeah, it's been so busy." He pointed to his food.
"I had to start already. Sorry about that. To be honest, I didn't totally expect you to show up."
"I'm sorry for being late," she said.
"No, believe me, I get it. You need to handle the Monday flow. The customers expect it. Lunch is pretty secondary."
"I have to say, I felt bad about the end of our conversation that night. Sorry about Annie."
"Did you guys actually make out?
I tried to find a spot where I could watch from, but..."
"No.
I thought if I climbed a tree..." "No, no. That's just Annie. She's an idiot."
"She's an idiot who happens to be in the top 1% of people here. I wish I was that kind of idiot."
"You were talking about when you were a kid?"
"God. Can I blame it on the wine?"
"You don't have to tell me anything." May felt terrible, already knowing what she did, hoping he would tell her so she could take the previous, second-hand version of his story and write over it with the version directly from him.
"No, it's fine," he said. "I got to meet a lot of interesting adults who were paid by the government to care for me. It was awesome. What do you have left, 10 minutes?
"I have till 1.
"Good. 8 more minutes, then. Eat, I'll talk. But not about my childhood, you know enough. I assume Annie filled in the gory stuff. She likes to tell that story."
And so May tried to eat as much as she could, as fast as she could, while Francis talked about a movie he'd seen the night before in the campus theater. Apparently the director had been there to present it, and had answered questions afterward.
"The movie was about a woman who kills her husband and kids, and during the Q&A, we find out this director's involved in this protracted custody battle with her own ex-husband. So we were all looking around thinking, is this lady working out some issues on screen, or..."
May laughed, and then, remembering his own horrible childhood, she caught herself. "It's fine," he said, knowing immediately why she'd paused.
"I don't want you to think you have to tiptoe around me. It's been a long time, and if I didn't feel comfortable in this territory, I wouldn't be working on Child Track."
"Well, still, I'm sorry. I'm bad at knowing what to say, but... So the project is going well? How close are you to..."
You're still so off balance. I like that, Francis said.
You like a woman who's off balance?
Especially in my presence. I want you on your toes, off balance, intimidated, handcuffed, and willing to prostrate yourself at my command.
May wanted to laugh, but found she couldn't.
Francis was staring at his plate. Shit. Every time my brain parks the car neatly in the driveway, my mouth drives through the back of the garage. I'm sorry. I swear I'm working on this.
It's fine. Tell me about...
Child Trek.
He looked up. You really want to know?
I do. Because once you get me started, it'll make your Monday deluge look like a tinkle.
We have 5.5 minutes left.
Okay, remember when they tried to do the implants in Denmark?
May shook her head. She had some vague recollection of a terrible child abduction and murder.
Francis checked his watch, as if knowing that explaining Denmark would steal a minute from him.
He sighed and started in.
So a couple years ago, the government of Denmark tried a program where they inserted chips in kids' wrists. It's easy, takes 2 seconds, it's medically sound, and instantly, it works. Every parent knows where their kid is at all times. They limited it to under 14s, and at first, everyone's fine. The court challenges are dropped because there are so few objections, the polling is through the roof, the parents love it. I mean, love it. These are kids, and we do anything to keep them safe, right?
May nodded, but suddenly remembered that this story ended horribly.
But then 7 kids go missing one day. The cops, the parents think, hey, no problem, we know where the kids are. They follow the chips, but when they get to the chips, all 7 tracking to some parking lot, they find them all in a paper bag, all bloody, just the chips.
Now I remember. May felt sick.
They find the bodies a week later, and by then, the public is in a panic. Everyone's irrational. They think the chips caused the kidnapping, the murders, that somehow the chips provoked whoever did this, made the task more tempting.
That was so horrible. That was the end of the chips.
Yeah, but the reasoning was illogical. Especially here. We have, what, 12,000 abductions a year? How many murders? The problem there was how shallow the chips were placed. Anyone can just cut it out of someone's wrist if they wanted to. Too easy. But the tests we're doing here... Did you meet Sabine?
I did.
Well, she's on the team. She won't tell you that because she's doing some related stuff she can't talk about, but for this, she figured out a way to put a chip in the bone, and that makes all the difference.
Oh, shit. What bone?
Doesn't matter, I don't think.
You're making a face.
May corrected her face, tried to look neutral. Sure, it's insane. I mean, some people freak out about chips in our heads, our bodies, but this thing is about as technologically advanced as a walkie-talkie. It doesn't do anything but tell you where something is. And they're everywhere already. Every other product you buy has one of these chips. You buy a stereo, it has a chip. You buy a car, it's got a bunch of chips. Some companies put chips in food packaging to make sure it's fresh when it gets to market. It's just a simple tracker. And if you embed it in bone, it stays there and can't be seen with the naked eye. Not like the wrist ones.
May put down her burrito. Really? In the bone?
May, think about a world where there could never again be a significant crime against a child. None possible. The second a kid's not where he's supposed to be, a massive alert goes off, and the kid can be tracked down immediately. Everyone can track her. All authorities know instantly she's missing, but they know exactly where she is. They can call the mom and say, hey, she just went to the mall, or they can track down some molester in seconds. The only hope an abductor would have is to take a kid, run into the woods with her, do something, and run off before the world descends upon him. But he would have about 1.5 minutes to do it.
Or if they could jam the transmission from the chip.
Sure, but who has that expertise? How many electronic genius pedophiles are there? Very few, I'm guessing. So immediately you take all child abduction, rape, murder, and you reduce it by 99%. And the price is that the kids have a chip in their ankle. You want a living kid with a chip in his ankle? A kid who you know will grow up safe? A kid who can again run down to the park, ride his bike to school, all that?
You're about to say, or...
Right. Or do you want a dead kid? Or years of worry every time your kid walks to the bus stop? I mean, we've polled parents worldwide, and after they get over the initial squeamishness, we get an 88% approval. Once they get it in their head that this is possible, we have them yelling at us, why don't we already have this? When's it coming? I mean... This will begin a new golden age for young people, an age without worry.
Shit,
Now you're late. Look. He pointed to the clock. 1:02. May. Ran. The afternoon was relentless, and her score barely reached 93. By the end of the day, she was exhausted, and she turned to her second screen to find a message from Dan.
Got a second? Gina from Circle Social was hoping to grab a few minutes with you.
She wrote him back.
How about in 15? I have a handful of follow-ups to do and haven't peed since noon.
This was the truth. She hadn't left her chair in 3 hours, and she also wanted to see if she could get the score above 93. She was sure this, her low aggregate, was why Dan wanted her to meet with Gina. Dan wrote only,
"Thank you, May."
Words that she turned over in her mind as she made her way to the bathroom. Was he thanking her for being available in 15 minutes, or thanking her, grimly, for an unwanted level of hygienic intimacy? May was almost at the bathroom door when she saw a man in skinny green jeans and a snug, long-sleeved shirt standing in the hallway under a tall, narrow window, staring at his phone. Bathed in a blue-white light, he seemed to be waiting for instructions from his screen. May went inside. When she was finished, she opened the door to find the man in the same place, now looking out the window.
"You look lost," May said.
"Nah, just figuring out something before, you know, heading upstairs."
"You work over here?"
"I do. I'm new. In CE.
CE?
Customer experience.
"Oh, right. We used to just call it customer service."
"So I take it you're not new?"
"Me?
No, no. I've been here a little while. Not so much in this building." He smiled and looked out the window, and with his face turned away, May took him in. His eyes were dark, his face oval, and his hair was gray, almost white, but he couldn't have been older than 30. He was thin, sinewy, and his skinny jeans and tight long-sleeved jersey gave his silhouette the quick, thick-thin brushstrokes of calligraphy. He turned back to her, blinking, scoffing at himself and his poor manners.
"Sorry, I'm Calden."
"Calden?"
"It's Tibetan," he said. "It means golden something. My parents always wanted to go to Tibet, but never got closer than Hong Kong."
"And your name?"
"May,"
she said, and they shook hands. His handshake was sturdy but perfunctory. He'd been taught how to shake hands, May guessed, but had never seen the point.
"So you're not lost?"
May said, realizing she was expected back at her desk. She'd already been late once today. Calden sensed it.
"Oh, you have to go. Can I walk you there, just to see where you work?"
May said, now feeling very unsettled. "Sure." If she hadn't known better and couldn't see the ID cord around his neck, she would have assumed Calden, with his pointed but unfocused curiosity, was either someone who'd wandered off the street or some kind of corporate spy. But she didn't know anything. She'd been at the Circle a week. This could be some sort of test, or just an eccentric fellow circler. May led him back to her desk.
"It's very clean," he said.
"I know, I just started, remember?
And I know some of the wise men like the Circle desk very tidy. You ever see those guys around here?"
"Who, the wise men?" May scoffed.
"Not here. Not yet, at least."
"Yeah, I guess not," Calden said, and crouched, his head at the level of May's shoulder.
"Can I see what you do?"
"For my work?"
"Yeah, can I watch?
I mean, not if it makes you uncomfortable." May paused. Everything and everyone else she'd experienced at the Circle hewed to a logical model, a rhythm, but Calden was the anomaly. His rhythm was different, atonal and strange, but not unpleasant. His face was so open, his eyes liquid, gentle, unassuming, and he spoke so softly that any possibility of threat seemed remote.
"Sure, I guess,"
she said.
"It's not so exciting, though."
"Maybe, maybe not." And so he watched May answer requests. When she turned to him after every seemingly mundane part of her job, the screen danced brightly in his eyes, his face rapt, like he'd never seen anything more interesting in his life.
At other moments, though, he seemed removed, seeing something she couldn't. He'd look at the screen, but his eyes were seeing something deep within. She continued, and he continued to ask occasional questions. Now, who was that? How often does that happen? Why did you respond in that way? He was close to her, far too close if he was a normal person with everyday ideas of personal space, but it was abundantly clear he was not this kind of person, a normal kind of person. As he watched the screen, and sometimes May's fingers on the keyboard, his chin got ever closer to her shoulder, his breath light but audible, his smell, a simple one of soap and banana shampoo, coming to her on the winds of his tiny exhalations. The whole experience was so odd that May laughed nervously every few seconds, not knowing what else to do. And then it was done. He cleared his throat and stood up. "Well, I better head out," he said. "I'll just slip away. Don't want to interrupt your pace here. I'll see you around campus, I'm sure." And he was gone. Before May could unpack any of what just happened, a new face was beside her.
"Hi, I'm Gina. Dan said I'd be here?"
May nodded, though she didn't remember anything about this. She looked at Gina, a woman a few years older than herself, hoping to remember something about her or this meeting. Gina's eyes, black and heavy with eyeliner and moon-blue mascara, smiled at her, though May felt no warmth emanating from those eyes, or from Gina at all.
"Dan said this would be a good moment to set up all your socials. You got time?"
"Sure," May said, though she had no time at all.
"I take it last week was too busy for you to set up your company's social account, and I don't think you've imported your old profile?"
May cursed herself.
"I'm sorry. I've been pretty overwhelmed so far."
Gina frowned.
May backtracked, masking her miscalculation with a laugh. "No, in a good way, but I haven't had time yet to do extracurricular stuff."
Gina tilted her head and cleared her throat theatrically.
"That's so interesting you put it that way," she said, smiling, though she didn't seem happy. "We actually see your profile and the activity on it as integral to your participation here. This is how your co-workers, even those on the other side of campus, know who you are. Communication is certainly not extracurricular, right?"
Now May was embarrassed.
"Right," she said. "Of course. If you visit a coworker's page and write something on the wall, that's a positive thing. That's an act of community, an act of reaching out. And, of course, I don't have to tell you that this company exists because of the social media you consider extracurricular. My understanding was that you used our social media tools before coming here."
May was unsure what she could say to appease Gina. She'd been so busy at work and didn't want to seem distracted, so she delayed reactivating her social profile.
"I'm sorry," May managed. "I didn't mean to imply that it was extracurricular. I actually think it's central. I was just getting acclimated here at work and wanted to focus on learning my new responsibilities."
But Gina had hit a groove and would not be stopped until she'd finished her thought.
"You realize that community and communication come from the same root word, communis, Latin for common, public, shared by all or many?"
May's heart was hammering.
"I'm very sorry, Gina. I fought to get a job here. I do know all this. I'm here because I believe in everything you said. I was just a bit crazed last week and didn't get a chance to set it up."
"Okay.
But just know from now on that being social and being a presence on your profile and all related accounts, this is part of why you're here. We consider your online presence to be integral to your work here. It's all connected."
"I know. Again, I'm sorry to have misstated my feelings."
"Good. Okay, let's start by setting this up."
Gina reached over May's divider and retrieved another screen, bigger than her second screen, which she quickly arranged and connected to May's computer.
"Okay, so your second screen will continue to be the way you'll stay in touch with your team. That will be exclusively for CE business. Your third screen is for your social participation in the company circle and your wider circle. Does that make sense?"
"It does."
May watched Gina activate the screen and felt a thrill. She'd never had such an elaborate arrangement before. Three screens for someone so low on the ladder? Only at the circle.
"Okay, first I want to go back to your second screen," Gina said. "I don't think you've activated circle search. Let's do that."
An elaborate, three-dimensional map of the campus appeared.
This is pretty simple, and just allows you to find anyone on campus in case you need a face-to-face.
Gina pointed to a pulsing red dot.
Here's you. You're red hot.
I'm kidding. As if recognizing that might have been considered inappropriate, Gina quickly moved on.
Didn't you say you knew Annie? Let's type in her name.
A blue dot appeared in the Old West. She's in her office. Surprise, surprise. Annie is a machine. May smiled. She is.
I'm so jealous you know her so well,
Gina said, smiling but briefly and unconvincingly.
And over here you'll see a cool new app which sort of gives us a history of the building every day. You can see when each staffer checked in every day, when they left the building. This gives us a really nice sense of the life of the company. This part you don't have to update yourself, of course. If you go to the pool, your ID automatically updates that on the feed, and outside of the movement, any additional commentary would be up to you, and of course would be encouraged.
Commentary? May asked.
You know, like what you thought of lunch, a new feature at the gym, anything. Just basic ratings and likes and comments. Nothing out of the ordinary. And of course, all input helps us do a better job at serving the Circle community. Now that commentary is done right here,
she said, and revealed that every building and room could be clicked on, and within, she could add any comments about anything or anyone.
So that's your second screen. It's about your coworkers, your team, and it's about finding people in the physical space. Now it's onto the really fun stuff. Screen 3. This is where your main social and Zing feeds appear.
I heard you weren't a Zing user. May admitted she hadn't been, but wanted to be.
Great, Gina said. So now you have a Zing account. I made up a name for you. Mayday. Like the war holiday. Isn't that cool?
May wasn't so sure about the name and couldn't remember a holiday by that name.
And I connected your Zing account with the Total Circle community, so you just got 10,041 new followers. Pretty cool. In terms of your own zinging, we'd expect about 10 or so a day, but that's sort of a minimum. I'm sure you'll have more to say than that. Oh, and over here's your playlist. If you listen to music while you work, the feed automatically sends that playlist out to everyone else, and it goes into the collective playlist, which ranks the most played songs in any given day, week, month. It has the top 100 songs campus-wide, but you can also slice it 1,000 ways. Top-played hip-hop, indie, country, anything. You'll get recommendations based on what you play and what others with similar taste play. It's all cross-pollinating while you're working. Make sense?
May nodded.
Now, next to the Zing feed, you'll see the window for your primary social feed. You'll also see that we split it into two parts, the inner circle social feed and your external social. That's your outer circle. Isn't that cute? You can merge them, but we find it helpful to see the two distinct feeds. But of course, the outer circle is still in the circle, right? Everything is. Make sense so far?
May said it did.
I can't believe you've been here a week without being on the main social feed. You're about to have your world rocked.
Gina tapped May's screen, and May's inner circle stream became a torrent of messages pouring down the monitor.
See? You're getting all last week's stuff, too. That's why there's so many. Wow, you really missed a lot.
May followed the counter on the bottom of the screen, calculating all the messages sent to her from everyone else at the circle. The counter paused at 1,200, then 4,400. The number scrambled higher, stopping periodically, but finally settling at 8,276.
That was last week's messages? 8,000? You can catch up,
Gina said brightly.
Maybe even tonight. Now, let's open up your regular social account. We call it Outer Circle, but it's the same profile, same feed as you've had for years. Mind if I open it up?
May didn't mind. She watched as her social profile, the one she'd first set up years ago, now appeared on her third screen next to the Inner Circle feed. A cascade of messages and photos, a few hundred, filled the monitor.
Okay, looks like you have some catching up to do here, too, Gina said. A feast! Have fun.
Thank you, May said. She tried to sound as excited as she could. She needed Gina to like her.
Oh, wait, one more thing. I should explain message hierarchy. Shit, I almost forgot message hierarchy. Dan would kill me. Okay, so you know that your first screen CE responsibilities are paramount. We have to serve our customers with our full attention and our full hearts. So that's understood.
It is.
On your second screen, you might get messages from Dan and Jared, or Annie, or anyone directly supervising your work. Those messages inform the minute-to-minute quality of your service, so that would be your second priority. Clear?
Clear.
The third screen is your social inner and outer circle, but these messages aren't, like, superfluous. They're just as important as any other messages, but are prioritized third, and sometimes they're urgent. Keep an eye on the inner circle feed in particular, because that's where you'll hear about staff meetings, mandatory gatherings, and any breaking news. If there's a circle notice that's really pressing, that'll be marked in orange. Something extremely urgent will prompt a message on your phone, too. You keep that in view.
May nodded at her phone, resting just below the screens on her desk.
Good, Gina said. So those are the priorities, with your fourth priority, your own outer circle participation, which is just as important as anything else because we value your work-life balance, you know, the calibration between your online life here at the company and outside it. I hope that's clear. Is it?
It is.
Good. So I think you're all set. Any questions?
May said she was fine. Gina's head tilted skeptically, indicating she knew that May actually had many questions still, but didn't want to ask them for fear of looking uninformed. Gina stood up, smiled, took a step back, but then stopped.
Crap! Forgot one more thing.
She crouched next to May, typed for a few seconds, and a number appeared on the third screen looking much like her aggregate CE score. It said, May Holland, 10,328.
This is your participation rank. Party rank, for short. Some people here call it the popularity rank, but it's not really that. It's just an algorithm-generated number that takes into account all your activity in the inner circle.
Does that make sense?
I think so. It takes into account zings, exterior followers of your intracompany zings, comments on your zings, your comments on others' zings, your comments on other circlers' profiles, your photos posted, attendance at circle events, comments and photos posted about those events. Basically, it collects and celebrates all you do here. The most active circlers are ranked highest, of course. As you can see, your rank is low now, but that's because you're new and we just activated your social feed. But every time you post or comment or attend anything, that gets factored in, and you'll see your rank change accordingly. That's where the fun comes in. You post, you rise in the rankings. A bunch of people like your post, and you really shoot up. It moves all day. Cool?
Very, May said.
We started you with a little boost. Otherwise, you'd be 10,411. And again, it's just for fun. You're not judged by your rank or anything. Some circlers take it very seriously, of course, and we love it when people want to participate. But the rank is really just a fun way to see how your participation manifests itself vis-a-vis the overall circle community. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, then. You know how to get hold of me.
And with that, Gina turned and left. May opened the intracompany stream and began. She was determined to get through all the inner and outer feeds that night. There were company-wide notices about each day's menus, each day's weather, each day's words of the wise. Last week's aphorisms were from MLK, Gandhi, Salk, Mother Teresa, and Steve Jobs. There were notices about each day's campus visits. A pet adoption agency, a state senator, a congressman from Tennessee, the director of Médecins Sans Frontières. May found out, with a sting of remorse, that she'd missed, that very morning, a visit from Muhammad Yunus, winner of the Nobel Prize. She plowed through the messages, every one, looking for anything she would have reasonably been expected to answer personally. There were surveys, at least 50 of them, gauging the circlers' opinions on various company policies, on optimal dates for upcoming gatherings, interest groups, celebrations, and holiday breaks. There were dozens of clubs soliciting members and notifying all of meetings. There were cat owner groups, at least 10, a few rabbit groups, 6 reptile groups, 4 of them adamantly snake exclusive. Most of all, there were groups for dog owners. She counted 22, but was sure that wasn't all of them. One of the groups dedicated to the owners of very small dogs, lucky lap dogs, wanted to know how many people would join a weekend club for walks and hikes and support. May ignored this one. Then, realizing that ignoring it would only prompt a second, more urgent message, she typed a message explaining that she didn't have a dog. She was asked to sign a petition for more vegan options at lunch. She did. There were 9 messages from various work groups within the company asking her to join their sub-circles for more specific updates and information sharing.
For now, she joined the ones dedicated to crochet, soccer, and Hitchcock. There seemed to be 100 parents' groups. First-time parents, divorced parents, parents of autistic children, parents of Guatemalan adoptees, Ethiopian adoptees, Russian adoptees. There were 7 improv comedy groups, 9 swim teams. There had been an inter-staff meet last Wednesday. Hundreds of swimmers participating, and 100 messages were about the contest, who won, some glitch with the results, and how a mediator would be on campus to settle any lingering questions or grievances. There were visits, 10 a day at least, from companies presenting innovative new products to the circle. New fuel-efficient cars, new fair trade sneakers, new locally sourced tennis rackets. There were meetings of every conceivable department. R&D, search, social, outreach, professional networking, philanthropic, ad sales. And with a plummeting of her stomach, May saw that she'd missed a meeting deemed pretty much mandatory for all newbies. That had been last Thursday. Why hadn't anyone told her? Well, stupid, she answered herself. They did tell you. Right here. Shit, she said. By 10 p.m., she'd made her way through all the intra-company messages and alerts, and now turned to her own outer circle account. She hadn't visited in 6 days, and found 118 new notices from that day alone. She decided to plow through, newest to oldest. Most recently, one of her friends from college had posted a message about having the stomach flu, and a long thread followed with friends making suggestions about remedies, some offering sympathy, some posting photos meant to cheer her up. May liked 2 of the photos, liked 3 of the comments, posted her own well wishes, and sent a link to a song, Puking Sally, that she'd found. That prompted a new thread, 54 notices, about the song and the band that wrote it. One of the friends on the thread said he knew the bassist in the band, and then looped him into the conversation. The bassist, Damien Galati, was in New Zealand, was a studio engineer now, but was happy to know that Puking Sally was still resonating with the flu-ridden. His post thrilled all involved, and another 129 notices appeared, everyone thrilled to hear from the actual bassist from the band, and by the end of the thread, Damien Galati was invited to play a wedding, if he wanted, or visit Boulder or Bath or Gainesville or St. Charles, Illinois, any time he happened to be passing through, and he would have a place to stay and a home-cooked meal. Upon the mention of St. Charles, someone asked if anyone from there had heard about Tim Jenkins, who was fighting in Afghanistan. They'd seen some mention of a kid from Illinois being shot to death by an Afghan insurgent posing as a police officer. 60 messages later, the respondents had determined that it was a different Tim Jenkins, this one from Rantoul, Illinois, not St. Charles. There was relief all around, but soon the thread had been overtaken by a multi-participant debate about the efficacy of that war, U.S. foreign policy in general, whether or not we won in Vietnam or Grenada or even World War I, and the ability of the Afghans to self-govern, and the opium trade financing the insurgents, and the possibility of legalization of any and all illicit drugs in America and Europe. Someone mentioned the usefulness of marijuana in alleviating glaucoma, and someone else mentioned it was helpful for those with MS, too. And then there was a frenetic exchange between 3 family members of MS patients, and May, feeling some darkness opening its wings within her, signed off. May could no longer keep her eyes open. Though she'd only made it through 3 days of her social backlog, she shut down and made for the parking lot. Tuesday morning's shoot was lighter than Monday's, but the activity on her third screen kept her in her chair for the day's first 3 hours. Before the third screen, there had always been a lull, maybe 10 or 12 seconds, between when she'd answered a query and when she knew whether or not the answer had been satisfying. She'd used the time to memorize the boilerplates and do a few follow-ups, every so often to check her phone. But now that became more challenging. The third screen feed dropped 40 new inner circle messages every few minutes, 15 or so outer circle posts and zings, and May used every available moment of downtime to quickly scroll through, make sure there was nothing that demanded her immediate attention, and then come back to her main screen. By the end of the morning, the flow was manageable, even exhilarating. The company had so much going on, so much humanity and good feeling, and was pioneering on all fronts that she knew she was being improved just by being in the circler's proximity. It was like a well-curated organic grocery store. You knew by shopping there that you were healthier. You couldn't make a bad choice, because everything had been vetted already. Likewise, everyone at the circle there had been chosen, and thus the gene pool was extraordinary, the brain power phenomenal. It was a place where everyone endeavored, constantly and passionately, to improve themselves, each other, share their knowledge, disseminate it to the world. By lunchtime, though, she was wiped out and very much looking forward to sitting, with her cerebral cortex removed, for an hour on the lawn with Annie, who had insisted on it. At 11:50, though, a second screen message from Dan appeared.
"You got a few mins?"
She told Annie she might be late, and when she arrived to Dan's office, he was leaning against the door jamb. He smiled sympathetically at May, but with a raised eyebrow, as if there was something about May that was perplexing him, something he couldn't put his finger on. He extended his arm into the office, and she slipped past him. He closed the door.
"Sit down, May. You know Alistair, I assume."
She hadn't seen the man sitting in the corner, but now that she saw him, she knew she didn't know him. He was tall, in his late 20s, with a careful swirl of sandy brown hair. He was positioned diagonally against a rounded chair, his thin frame resting stiffly, like a 2x4. He didn't stand a meter, so May extended her hand to him.
"Nice to meet you," she said.
Alistair sighed with great resignation and extended his hand as if he were about to touch something washed ashore and rotting. May's mouth went dry. There was something very wrong. Dan sat down.
"Now, I hope we can make this right as soon as possible," he said. "Would you like to start, May?"
The two men looked at her. Dan's eyes were steady, while Alistair's look was hurt but expectant. May had no idea what to say, no idea what was happening. As the silence festered and grew, Alistair blinked furiously, holding back tears.
"I can't believe this," he managed to say.
Dan turned to him.
"Alistair, come on. We know you're hurting, but let's keep it in perspective."
Dan turned to May.
"I'll point out the obvious, May. We're talking about Alistair's Portugal brunch."
Dan let the words linger, expecting May to jump in, but May had no idea what those words meant.
Alistair's Portugal brunch?
Could she say she had no idea what that meant? She knew she couldn't. She'd been late to the feed. This must have something to do with that.
"I'm sorry," she said. She knew she would have to tread water until she could figure out what all this was about.
"That's a good start," Dan said. "Right, Alistair?"
Alistair shrugged. May continued fumbling. What did she know? There had been a brunch, that much was certain, and clearly she had not been there. The brunch was planned by Alistair, and now he was hurt. All this was reasonable to assume.
"I wish I could have been there," she ventured,
and immediately saw slight signs of confirmation in their faces. She was on to something.
"But I wasn't sure if..."
Now she took a leap.
"I wasn't sure if I was welcome, being so new here."
Their faces softened. May smiled, knowing she'd hit the right note. Dan shook his head, happy to have his assumption that May was not an inherently bad person confirmed. He got up from his chair, came around his desk, and leaned against it.
"May, have we not made you feel welcome?" he asked.
"No, you have. You really have, but I'm not a member of Alistair's team, and I wasn't quite sure what the rules were about, you know, members of my team attending the brunches of more seasoned members of other teams."
Dan nodded.
"See, Alistair? I told you it was easily explained."
Now Alistair was sitting upright, as if ready to engage again.
"Well, of course you're welcome," he said, patting her knee playfully. "Even if you're a little oblivious..."
"Now, Alistair..."
"I'm sorry," he said, and took a deep breath. "I've got it under control now. I'm very happy."
There were a few more statements of apology and laughs about understandings and misunderstandings and communications and flow and mistakes and the order of the universe, and finally it was time to let it go. They stood.
"Let's hug it out,"
Dan said. And they did, forming a tight scrum of newfound communion. By the time May was back at her desk, a message was waiting for her.
"Thanks again for coming to meet Alistair and me today. I think that was very productive and helpful. HR knows about the situation, and to close it out, they always like to get a statement together. So I typed this up. If it sounds good, just sign it on screen and send it back."
Glitch number 5616ARN/MRH/RK2. Day,
Monday, June 11th. Participants, May Holland, Alistair Knight. Story. Alistair of the Renaissance, Team 9, held a brunch for all staffers who had demonstrated an interest in Portugal. He sent out 3 notices about the event, none of which May, of the Renaissance, Team 6, answered. Alistair became concerned that there was no RSVP or communication of any kind from May. When the brunch occurred, May did not attend, and Alistair understandably was distressed about why she would not respond to repeated invitations and then fail to attend. This was non-participation in a classic sense. Today, a meeting was held between Dan, Alistair, and May, where May explained that she was not sure that she was welcome at such an event, given it was being hosted by a member of a different team, and she was in her second week of life at the company. She feels very bad about causing worry and emotional distress to Alistair, not to mention threatening the delicate ecology of the Renaissance. Now all is worked out, and Alistair and May are great friends and feel rejuvenated. All agree a fresh start is warranted and welcome. There was a line below the statement where May was to sign, and she used her fingernail to sign her name on the screen. She submitted it, and instantly received a thank you from Dan.
"That was great," he wrote. "Alistair is obviously a little sensitive, but that's only because he's such a fiercely committed circler, just like you, right? Thank you for being so cooperative. You were great. Onward."
May was late, and hoped Annie would still be waiting. The day was clear and warm, and May found Annie on the lawn, typing on her tablet with a granola bar dangling from her mouth. She squinted up at May.
"Hey, you're tardy."
"Sorry."
"How are you?"
May made a face.
I know, I followed the whole thing,"
Annie said, chewing extravagantly.
"Stop eating like that. Close your mouth."
"You did?"
"I was just listening while I worked. They asked me to, and I've heard much worse. Everyone has a few of those early on. Eat fast, by the way. I want to show you something."
In quick succession, 2 waves passed over May. First, profound unease that Annie had been listening without her knowledge, followed by a wave of relief, knowing her friend had been with her, even if remotely, and could confirm that May would survive.
"Did you?"
she asked.
"Did I what?"
"Ever get called on the carpet like that? I'm still shaking."
"Of course. Once a month, maybe. I still do. Chew fast."
May ate as quickly as she could, watching a game of croquet being played on the lawn. The players seemed to have made up their own rules. May finished her lunch.
"Good, get up,"
Annie said, and they made their way toward Tomorrow Town.
"What? Your face still has a question protruding from it."
"Did you go to that Portugal brunch?"
Annie scoffed.
"Me? No. Why? I wasn't invited."
"But why was I? I didn't sign up for it. I'm not some Portugal freak."
"It's on your profile, isn't it? Didn't you go there once?"
"Sure, but I never mentioned it on my profile. I've been to Lisbon, but that's it. That was 5 years ago."
They approached the Tomorrow Town building, fronted by a wall of ironwork that looked vaguely Turkish. Annie waved her pass over a wall-mounted pad, and the door opened.
"Did you take pictures?" Annie asked.
"In Lisbon? Sure."
"And they were on your laptop?"
May had to think a second.
"I guess so." "Then that's probably it. If they were on your laptop, now they're in the cloud, and the cloud gets scanned for information like that. You don't have to run around signing up for Portugal interest clubs or anything. When Alistair wanted to do his brunch, he probably just asked for a search of everyone on campus who had visited the country, took pictures, or mentioned it in an email or whatever. So then he automatically gets a list and sends his invitation out. It saves about 100 hours of nonsense. Over here."
They stopped in front of a long hallway. Annie's eyes were alight with mischief.
"Okay. You want to see something surreal?"
"I'm still weirded out."
"Don't be. Get in here."
Annie opened the door to a beautiful room, some cross between a buffet and a museum and a trade show.
"How crazy is this?"
The room looked vaguely familiar. May had seen something like this on TV.
"It's like one of those gift bag places for celebrities, right?"
May scanned the room. There were products spread all over dozens of tables and platforms. But here, instead of jewelry and pumps, there were sneakers and toothbrushes and 12 types of chips and drinks and energy bars. May laughed.
"I'm guessing this is free?"
"For you. For very important people like you and me, yes."
Jesus Christ,
All of this?
Yup.
This is the free sample room. It's always full, and this stuff needs to get used one way or the other. We invite rotating groups in. Sometimes it's programmers, sometimes CE people like you. Different group, every day.
And you just take whatever you want?
Well, you have to zap your ID on anything you're taking so they know who's taken what. Otherwise, some idiot takes home the whole room.
I haven't seen any of this stuff yet.
In stores?
No, none of this stuff is in stores yet. These are prototypes and test runs.
These are actual Levi's?
May was holding a pair of beautiful jeans, and she was sure they did not yet exist in the world.
They might be a few months till market, maybe a year. You want those? You can ask for a different size.
And I can wear them?
As opposed to what? Wiping your ass with them?
Yeah, they want you to wear them. You're an influential person working at the Circle. You're a style leader, early adopter, all that.
These are actually my size.
Good. Take two. You have a bag?
Annie retrieved a cloth bag with the Circle logo on it and gave it to May, who was hovering over a display of new phone covers and accessories. She picked up a beautiful phone shell that was sturdy as stone, but with a chamois smooth surface.
Crap, May said. I didn't bring my phone.
What? Where is it?
Annie asked, astounded.
I guess at my desk.
May, you are incredible. You're so focused and together, but then you have these weird, spacey lapses. You came to lunch without your phone?
Sorry.
No, it's what I love about you. You're like part human, part rainbow.
What? Don't get upset.
I'm just getting a lot of input today.
You're not still worried, are you?
You think it's okay, that meeting with Dan and Alistair?
It's definitely okay.
He's just that sensitive?
Annie rolled her eyes. Alistair, beyond all reason, but he writes great code. The guy is a machine. It'd take a year to find and train someone to do what he does, so we have to deal with the crazy. There are just some nuts here, needy nuts, and there are those, like Dan, who enable the nuts. But don't worry, I don't think you'll overlap much, with Alistair at least.
Annie checked the time. She had to go.
You stay till that bag is full, she said. I'll see you later.
May stayed and filled her bag with jeans and food and shoes and a few new covers for her phone, a sports bra. She left the room, feeling like a shoplifter, but encountered no one on the way out. When she got back to her desk, there were 11 messages from Annie. She read the first.
Hey, May, realizing I shouldn't have gone off on Dan and Alistair that way wasn't very nice, not circly at all. Pretend I didn't say it.
The second.
You get my last message?
The third.
Starting to freak out a little. Why aren't you answering me?
Fourth.
Just texted you, called you. Are you dead?
Shit, forgot your phone. You suck.
Fifth.
If you were offended by what I said about Dan, don't go all silent treatment.
I said sorry. Right back.
Sixth.
Are you getting these messages? It's be important. Call me.
Seventh.
If you're telling Dan what I said, you're a bitch. Since when do we tattle on each other?
Eighth.
Realizing you might just be in a meeting.
True?
Ninth. It's been 25 minutes. What is up?
Tenth.
Just checked and see that you're back at your desk. Call me this instant or we're through. I thought we were friends.
11th.
Hello?
May called her.
What the hell, Spaz?
Where were you?
I saw you 20 minutes ago. I finished in the sample room, used the bathroom, and now I'm here.
Did you tell on me?
Did I what?
Did you tell on me?
Annie, what the fuck?
Just tell me.
No, I didn't tell on you. To who?
What did you say to him?
Who?
Dan.
I haven't even seen him. You didn't send a message to him?
No, Annie, shit.
Promise?
Yes.
Annie sighed.
Okay. Fuck. Sorry. I sent him a message and called him and hadn't heard back. And then I didn't hear back from you, and my brain just put all this together in a weird way.
Annie, shit.
Sorry.
I think you're overstressed.
No, I'm fine.
Let me get you some drinks tonight.
Thanks, no.
Please?
I can't. We have too many things going on here this week. Just trying to deal with this clusterfuck in Washington.
Washington? What about it?
It's such a long story. I can't say, actually. But you're the one that has to handle it? All of Washington? They give me some of the government hassle stuff because, I don't know, because they think my dimples help? Maybe they do. I don't know. I just wish there were five of me. You sound terrible, Annie. Take a night off. No, no, I'll be fine. I just have to answer these queries from some subcommittee. It'll be fine, but I better go. Love you.
And she hung up. May called Francis.
Annie won't go out with me. Will you? Tonight?
Out? There's a band here tonight. You know the Creamers? They're playing in the colony. It's a benefit.
May said yes, that sounded good, but when the time came, she didn't want to see a band called the Creamers play in the colony. She cajoled Francis into her car, and they left for San Francisco.
You know where we're going? He asked.
I don't.
What are you doing? He was typing furiously into his phone.
I'm just telling everyone I'm not coming.
Finished?
Yes. He dropped his phone.
Good. Let's drink first.
And so they parked downtown and found a restaurant that looked so terrible, with faded and unappetizing pictures of the food taped haphazardly to the windows, that they figured it might be cheap. They were right, and they ate curry and drank singa, and sat in bamboo chairs that squealed and strained to stay erect. Somewhere toward the end of her first beer, May decided that she would have a second, quickly, and that shortly after dinner, she would kiss Francis on the street. They finished dinner, and she did.
Thank you, he said.
Did you just thank me?
You just saved me so much inner turmoil. I've never made the first move in my life, but usually it takes a woman weeks to figure out she'll have to take the initiative.
Again, May had the feeling of being clubbed with information that complicated her feelings about Francis, who seemed so sweet one moment and so strange and unfiltered the next. Still, because she was riding at the crest of a singa wave, she led him by the hand back to her car, where they kissed more, while parked on a very busy intersection. A homeless man was watching them, as an anthropologist would from the sidewalk, miming the taking of notes.
Let's go, she said, and they left the car and wandered through the city, finding a Japanese souvenir shop open, and, next to it, also open, a gallery full of photorealistic paintings of gigantic human haunches.
Big pictures of big asses,
Francis noted, as they found a bench in an alley-turned piazza, the street lamps above giving it the look of blue moonlight.
That was real art. I couldn't believe they hadn't sold anything yet.
May kissed him again. She was in a kissing mood, and knowing that Francis wouldn't make any aggressive moves, she felt at ease kissing him more, knowing it would be only kissing tonight. She threw herself into the kissing, making it mean lust and friendship and the possibility of love, and kissed him while thinking of his face, wondering if his eyes were open, if he cared about the passers-by who clucked or who hooted but still passed by. In the days that followed, May knew that it could be true, that the sun could be her halo, that the leaves could exist to marvel at her every step, to urge her on, to congratulate her on this Francis, what the two of them had done. They had celebrated their shimmering youth, their freedom, their wet mouths, and had done so in public, fueled by the knowledge that whatever hardships they had faced or would face, they were working at the center of the world and trying mightily to improve it. They had reason to feel good. May wondered if she was in love. No, she knew she was not in love, but she was, she felt, at least halfway. That week, she and Francis ate lunch together often, even if briefly, and after they ate, they found a place to lean against each other and kiss. Once it was under a fire exit behind the Paleozoic. Once it was in the Roman Empire, behind the paddle courts. She loved his taste, always clean, simple like lemon water, and how he would remove his glasses, look briefly lost, then would close his eyes and look almost beautiful, his face as smooth and uncomplicated as a child's. Having him near brought a new crackle to the days. Everything was astounding. Eating was astounding, under the bright sun, the heat of his shirt, his hands on her ankle. Walking was astounding. Sitting in the Enlightenment was astounding, as they were now doing, awaiting Dream Friday in the Great Hall.
Pay attention, Francis said.
I really think you'll like this.
Francis wouldn't tell me what the subject of that Friday's innovation talk was. The speaker, Gus Cazzani, had apparently been part of Francis's child safety project before he spun off, 4 months ago, to head up a new unit. Today would be his first airing of his findings and new plan. May and Francis sat near the front at Gus's request. He wanted to see some friendly faces as he spoke, for the first time in the Great Hall, Francis said. May turned to scan the crowd, seeing Dan a few rows back, and Renata and Sabine sitting together, concentrating on a tablet laid between them. Eamon Bailey stepped onto the stage to warm applause.
"Well, we really have a treat for you today," he said. "Most of you know our local treasurer and jack-of-all-trades, Gus Cazzani, and most of you know he had an inspiration a while back that we urged him to follow. Today he'll do a bit of a presentation, and I think you'll really like it."
And with that, he ceded the stage to Gus, who had the odd combination of preternaturally good looks and a timid, mouse-like demeanor. Or at least it seemed that way, as he pittered across the stage like he was tiptoeing.
"Okay, if you're like me, you're single and pathetic and forever a disappointment to your Persian mother and father and grandparents who see you as a failure for not having a mate and children by now because you're pathetic."
Laughs from the audience.
"Did I use the word pathetic twice?"
More laughter.
"If my family was here, it would have been many more times."
"Okay," Gus continued.
"But let's say you want to please your family, and maybe yourself too, by finding a mate. Anyone interested in finding a mate here?"
A few hands rose up.
"Oh, come on, you liars. I happen to know that 67% of this company is unmarried, so I'm talking to you. The other 33% can go to hell."
May laughed out loud. Gus's delivery was perfect. She leaned over to Francis.
"I love this guy."
He continued.
"Now maybe you tried other dating sites, and let's say you're matched up and that's all good, and you're headed out for a rendezvous. All good, the family's happy, they briefly entertain the idea that you're not a worthless use of their shared DNA. Now the second you ask someone out, you're screwed, right? Actually, you're not screwed. You're celibate, but you want to change that. So you spend the rest of the week stressing over where to take them. Food, concert, wax museum, some kind of dungeon. You have no idea. The wrong choice, and you're an idiot. You know that you have a wide variety of tastes, things you like, and they probably do too, but that first choice is too important. You need help to send the right message. The message being that you're sensitive, intuitive, decisive, you have good taste, and you're perfect."
The crowd was laughing. They hadn't stopped laughing. The screen behind Gus now showed a grid of icons with information listed clearly below each. May could make out what seemed to be symbols for a restaurant, for movies, music, shopping, outdoor activities, beaches.
"Okay," Gus continued. "So check this out. And remember, it's just a beta version. This is called Love Love. Okay, maybe that name sucks. Actually, I know it sucks, and we're working on it, but this is how it works. When you found someone and you have their name, you made contact, you have a date planned, this is when Love Love comes in. Maybe you've already memorized their dating site page, their personal page, all their feeds, but this Love Love gives you an entirely different set of information. So you feed in your date's name, that's the start. Then Love Love scans the web and uses some high-powered and very surgical search machinery to ensure that you don't make an ass out of yourself and that you might find love and produce grandchildren for your baba, who thinks you might be sterile."
"You're awesome, Gus,"
a woman's voice yelled from the audience.
"Thank you."